This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hey, this is a very special episode of Kelly Corrigan Wonders to celebrate the end of 2020. It was a year that nearly broke us. And as a bit of self-soothing and reflection, I went heads down, paging through my journal from the whole year, not to mention everything I've written for publication, looking for silver linings, sure that they must be there, some weirdly encouraging takeaways that I could round up for all of us so that we might step into 2021 on the right foot. I thought about change and loss, play and creativity, love and science, and the role of celebration. So let's do it, people. Let's spend 20 minutes looking at what just happened and what we might take away from 2020. One, change happens. So as you probably know from listening to the podcast, we are in the middle of a series about how change happens for a person or a country. And the experience of recording those conversations has been utterly uplifting because the fact that change does happen is like the most encouraging thing I can think of to say out loud. People I know stop drinking and stay sober for the rest of their life. People I know who are so low and desperate and suicidal get therapy and read books. They get to know new people in new ways, and they feel better. People I know who've lost the love of their life, love again. And on a societal level, there are two huge markers of change. One, I look at the size and composition and regularity and distribution of the civil rights protests this year. And I think it's amazing to see so many kinds of people in so many different places, calling for change and progress and something better. So I was lucky enough, thanks to the PBS show, to spend 2 days with Bryan Stevenson, the great civil rights attorney, in Alabama, and he is tired, but not hopeless. And he told me that every person who shows up to a protest is putting themselves in the path of transformation. So even if they're just jumping on the bandwagon or they had fun making signs with their friends or it was just a performance for their Instagram feed, it doesn't matter because once they're there, they might hear the thing that changes the way they think and helps change the world we live in. And of course, we're getting rid of all this dangerous iconography. Statues are coming down. We elected a woman of color to be our vice president. We bought millions of books to better see our privilege. And we are changing hiring practices and who's on a board. And all that together marks something. It's not enough. It's agonizingly slow, and it shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't still be happening. But nonetheless, it is change. Number two, we unleashed science on a global pandemic, and it is working.
This is Margaret Keenan. She was the first person to receive the Pfizer-BioNTech jab at the University College Hospital in Coventry. That's one of 70 hospitals around the UK which will be giving the vaccine to over 80s and some health and care staff.
That we are capable of such rapid adaptation, collaboration, and advancement, that we are constantly learning as individuals and as societies, I just think is not getting enough good publicity. As I said, in the case of basic civil rights, we're learning in some ways how far we have yet to go, but that's still learning. That's still seeing more and seeing more clearly. And then the vaccines, I mean, There are already 3 or 4. There are more coming, we must assume. And the implications here are really worth celebrating. They represent international teamwork, tremendous economic activity, and learnings that might be valuable in other diseases or future viruses. I mean, if you think about the mumps vaccine, which took 4 years to develop, and when it came out, people went crazy with fanfare and accolades. And then you think about 9 months to come up with an effective vaccine, an outrageously effective vaccine. I just feel like we should be dancing. So yes, responding to the global pandemic, as we might have guessed, has not been smooth or easy or pleasant, but I am looking right smack into the light at the end of the tunnel that we all got shoved into back in March, and that light is a sight for sore eyes. It's going to be a story we tell, like smallpox. So in 1967, the year I was born, 2 million people died of smallpox. Now, nobody. So let's just feel that for a second. We are still oversimplifying. The hero-villain all-or-nothing thing is not helping. Police are not uniformly heroic. Neither are teachers, doctors, politicians, even the ones we campaigned for. Nor are they uniformly corrupt. One of the most interesting conversations that happened on my Facebook page was in response to this idea my friend Andy always talks about, and not or. So many hundreds of people responded to this post, and they offered their own examples of ways that they themselves do not fit the mold they've been put into. They are not this or that. They are this and that. For instance, many people said they personally were pro-life, but completely pro-choice when it came to what the national law should be. And many mothers of servicemen and women admitted they support their children, of course, but they also wish we would decrease military spending. Republicans wanted to share that they definitely want stricter gun laws. And Democrats wanted to share that they definitely wanted stricter immigration laws. But of course, the people who sell us the daily story of America are incented to present a more black and white world on the verge of civil war, perfect for a juicy headline that will make you stay. Nuance doesn't sell, because nuance makes your head hurt. So conviction addiction, as I call it, is a funhouse mirror. It distorts reality. We can't be so sure so fast. We have to tune our bullshit meters to notice words like everyone, no one, I would never, and you always. If we're going to recommit to each other, which I hope we do, it's time for more curiosity and less judgment. So there were two specific and not or moments this year that I think about a lot. One is I was connecting with this woman, Valerie, on my Facebook page, and it was kind of early in shelter in place, and she mentioned that her husband had died, and now it was just her and her son, who was special needs. He was very active every day, but rarely spoke. And I said, I'm so sorry. And she said, you misunderstand me. My son is the best part of my life. So I asked her to tell me more about him, what he does and what he wants and what he loves. And she told me he loves the trampoline. He loves to stand at the edge of the ocean and let the waves kind of swirl around his ankles. And he loves walking on his tiptoes. He also loves her. For Valerie, it is different and hard and beautiful. A huge story in 2020 was Christian Cooper, who was that bird watcher in Central Park who asked the white woman to put her dog on a leash, and then she called the police to report that, quote, an African American was threatening her life. Days later, when Christian Cooper saw that 40 million people had watched the video and heard that she was fired, he said, I'm not excusing the racism, and I won't participate in my continued dehumanization, but I don't know if her life needed to be torn apart. To get that kind of tidal wave in such a compressed period of time, it's gotta hurt. So if you need a model for holding conflicting and painful blends of thoughts and feelings, look to Christian Cooper. Okay, so this brings me to my next takeaway, which is about moods. I've noticed that when I'm really feeling grim, it's because I'm thinking about myself and my people and my projects and my weight and my to-do list way too much. Me and my shit is filling the frame, and I have to get smaller. So I do this weird exercise where I pretend that I'm flying over the rooftops of the world and just peeking in on people's lives. And there I see someone falling in love, and there I see someone dying, yelling, eating, dancing, weeping, being born. And I just think 8 billion people. And that usually makes me the right size in the world. If it doesn't, I read a poem or an article in The New Yorker, like about this carpenter in Manhattan or some nutty performance artist. The more remote from my life, the better. Or I call someone I love and someone I miss, and I ask them a million questions. It sounds so Pollyanna, but it is the truth. Giving is the easiest way out of a funk. Everyone in the social sciences will tell you that the number one lever we have to flip from misery to something better is to be other-oriented. Building tiny houses, dropping off meals, dropping off PPE supplies or pizzas at the ER. Limitations drive creativity. And so this year we saw online DJs hosting nightly dance parties, and we saw birthday car parades, and we saw people playing cellos for essential workers in parking lots. Kurt Vonnegut said, "The purpose of human life is to love whoever's around to be loved." But while we're talking about moods, especially the moods of our children that we have experienced at close range thanks to quarantine, I have a new goal around metering my emotional intake. This might just be for me, but I really feel my kids' moods. Like, their moods become my moods. I can't interrupt the contagion. And I know I need to. I know that I need to watch their moods and not ride them. It is totally okay for a teenager to be cold or blue. I mean, honestly, what could be more predictable? It is their God-given right. And as the adult in the room, I am held to a different standard, especially in times when there are layers of national and global strife. Their work is to feel it all, and my work is to tend to my own emotional state and lead. Okay, next up is loss. Loss sucks. My friend Bert, a hematologist-oncologist I knew from volunteering at Children's Hospital in Oakland, kind of functioned for many years as my local dad. He made me feel smart, funny, and beautiful, and he died this year. And that brought me back to the grief about my own dad, and I just let it rip. I had 2 podcasts this month on loss, on feeling it. In one of them, I was talking to this palliative care doc named BJ Miller, whose sister died years ago right around Thanksgiving. And he and his parents tried at first to do Thanksgiving as people do. They tried putting on their Sunday best and gathering with others, but they quickly realized it would be impossible. They just couldn't play along. So they vowed to keep it to just the 3 of them so they could do whatever they needed to do that day. Get drunk in sweatpants, watch sad movies and play cards, cry or laugh. Whatever they needed, they would give themselves. Because grief is just the other side of love. Pain is part of what makes our life experience whole. And as such, it deserves its full due.
If you're trying to lead a life without pain, without sorrow, without sadness, if you're trying to lead a life without needing anything from anybody, you're essentially signing up for half a life. There's just no two ways about it. Pain, sadness, dependency, those are parts of a full life. It may be difficult, but if you want to have a full life, you need those too.
Also this month, it was 5 years since my friend Liz died, and her husband and I recorded a long, candid, profound conversation about love and loss and remembering. A thing I will never forgive 2024 is that people were robbed of a proper goodbye. As Megan said to me in the comments of one of my Instagram posts, without some kind of service, the emotions don't know how to move. There's a Rilke quote I keep close at all times. Let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Next is about love and attachment. So my dad was my person. I have said that many times. And over this past summer, I was walking with this young friend of mine, Rosie, whose mom is dying. And she said, "My mom is my person." And on the ride home, I was thinking that maybe I should suggest that both of us are drawing too small a circle. Maybe if we're open to it, over time, other people might rise into this cherished position. I mean, it's a mystery, really, right? I like to imagine a dark room where a new, most special person kind of thing is developing like a giant photograph in a pan. I can't see who it is yet, but something is happening. Maybe it's a mix of several people. Maybe it's a new group. So where there's grief and attachment, let love beget more love. If you did it, if you really gave someone your whole heart, you can do it again. In other words, the only thing you really need to believe to stay in the game is there is more coming for us. Next is a word on play. I think of us as flipper dolphins. I believe they're officially called spinner dolphins, but I prefer flipper. We need to come out of the water and spin around in the sun for no other reason than our own amusement. Some of the more obvious diversions and entertainments are unavailable at the moment because of travel restrictions and shelter in place and the whole horrible mess, but we can play games. I think of it as lake house. Like, I always wanted one. We never did round up enough dough, but then I ask myself, if we had a lake house, what would we be doing right now? And then I do it. Like, I put out a 1,000-piece puzzle and make some tea and relax in my own real house that I actually own and actually love. I also am a big believer in ping pong, backgammon, rummy cube, hearts, Wii, Dance Dance Revolution. Whatever it takes to get your spinner dolphin on, we must honor our nature, and that includes play. On the podcast, Wanda and I talked a lot about agency. It's a favorite idea of mine. And when you get that spinner dolphin thing going, you are exercising your agency. You're learning that we can and that we must change the channel in our own head, and that it's easier to do than we probably ever thought. Related to play is celebration. Celebration is highly recommended. This year, my husband and I put on our wedding clothes and got remarried with our two kids on our porch on April 29th to celebrate our 20th wedding anniversary. It was not what the plan was, and it was spectacular. Naming things, marking days, is so important. It forces reflection and a little analysis. It connects the dots between effort and good luck and outcomes. And really, it's like active gratitude. In celebration, it's never about what we don't have or what is missing. It's about what is right now, which, according to thousands of wise people over thousands of years, is exactly where we want to be. Celebrations are also unifying. They're motivating externalizations of values. They answer the question, what is worth stopping for, making a card for, singing a song for, eating carbohydrates for? And celebrations are commemorations. They are a co-remembering. And I think this sort of thing is doubly important in hard times for no other reason than that celebrating is also an act of agency. You weren't ruled by the circumstances. You didn't let the bad thing suppress the good thing. You took a bit of control, you popped some champagne, you raised a glass. This is my second to last one, which also points us to agency, which is a very hopeful idea. My friend Dave always says you pick your advice when you pick your advisor. And I say you pick your mood too. I mean, emotionally and intellectually, we are poorest creatures. As anyone who has ever cried reading a book or danced to music can attest, we can be made to feel anything. From vitriol to boredom to tear-jerking compassion, we choose our emotional state when we choose our media. Will we gorge on delicious righteousness? Think cable news. Soothe ourselves with carby platitudes, think Instagram, or fill our plate from the less appetizing salad bar of complexity, think podcasts. Because as thoughts and feelings go, we are what we eat. Another way I think about managing our intake is related to this thing my friend Meg told me, which is that we are an average of the five people we spend the most time with. So this year, it might be fewer actual live people and more writers and YouTubers and TikTokers and podcasters. I remember when my daughter was watching The Bachelorette and she'd come up from the basement where the TV is and she'd say all this weird melodramatic stuff like, don't try to invalidate me. I also remember that when we were watching Downton Abbey as a family, my daughter started setting the table with all this extra silverware. So thoughts and behaviors are highly transmissible, to use a metaphor that will surely resonate in 2020. We have to be intentional about what goes in front of our eyes and into our ears. That means clean out your feed, unsubscribe, pick a podcast that you want to ride shotgun on. There has never been so much good, smart, free content available in the history of man. Content that can refocus us effortlessly every day on what matters. Personally, I love the Making Sense podcast. I love Death, Sex, and Money. I love the Avett Brothers. My favorite Instagram followers are National Geographic, MoMA, and some generic accounts of places we've been as a family so I can remember the trip to Montana or our days in Lake Winnipesaukee. I used to think of things like that as acts of micro-agency, but actually, in total, it's your life. You are what you think about. That is your experience of existence. As I like to say, we live in our heads, so why not make it nice in there? So to wrap, I guess the thing 2020 proved for me is that it's still about the same things it's always been about. That's the very definition of universal truths. And number one for me is meaningful connection to others. We are a pro-social species. A headline will tell you it's all about hoarding and looting and fighting, but that's not the truth. I remember a stretch of time this spring when the number one question on Google was, how can I help? We need each other. If nothing else, we have come finally and forever to appreciate the profound fact of our shared humanity and relish the full force of our love for one another. So cheers to that. Okay, I want to end with a poem, but first, I want to thank you so much for being a part of the podcast with me. And I would like to ask you a favor. I was wondering if you're a fan of this podcast, if you would please put something in your social feed about the podcast, why you love it, why you listen to it, what you get out of it, and also a link to an episode that you found particularly satisfying. Okay, let's end with Ellen Bass, who is a poet who I actually ended up getting to know this year, who's kept me tethered to all the possible small goodnesses around us. And this poem is called Any Common Desolation. Any common desolation can be enough to make you look up at the yellowed leaves of the apple tree, the few that survived the rains and frost, shot with late afternoon sun. They glow a deep orange gold against a blue so sheer a single bird would rip it like silk. You may have to break your heart, but it isn't nothing to know even one moment alive. The sound of an oar in an oarlock, or a remnant animal tearing grass, the smell of grated ginger, the ruby neon of the liquor store sign, warm socks. You remember your mother, her precision a ceremony, as she gathered the white cotton, slipped it over your toes, drew up the heel, turned the cuff. A breath can uncoil as you walk across your own muddy yard, the Big Dipper pouring night down over you, and everything you dread, all you can't bear, dissolves. And like a needle slipped into your vein, that sudden rush of the world. Thanks, guys. Happy New Year.
From PRX.